You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Jay Duncan. Jay is no stranger to KTEP and, of course, El Pasoans, as he has been around television and media for a while. He is a film historian and also a collector of various sorts. But first, Jay, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
How did you get involved in the history of film? Mm-hmm. Were you always an avid movie watcher?
From the earliest days that I can remember, from like age five, that I can actually pinpoint, seeing certain films. Of course, I always loved movies. And then there was a film in 1951 that I think probably helped set the course for my lifelong interest in not only film, but to delve beneath the surface, the filmmakers, the writers, the music, the actual behind-the-scenes people that put together and crafted films. And that was The Day the Earth Stood Still. And even at that young age, probably didn't see all the various underlying levels of the storyline and the allegory that it was toward Christianity, actually, and some religious parallels, actually. From a child's viewpoint, I became insatiable. I had to see movies. And, of course, you know, during the early 50s, Walt Disney was re-releasing a lot of the classics from the 30s and 40s, and you had new films coming out of the Disney studios in the 50s, such as Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan and Cinderella and of course, his second live-action film, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And, of course, all of these, the fantasy element, the science fiction element from The Day the Earth Stood Still, the burgeoning 50s science fiction deluge on audiences with War of the Worlds and Forbidden Planet and This Island Earth and all of these films, was more candy than a kid could eat. You know, I mean, that was just it was eye candy. It was food for thought. A lot of these films were reflective of the 50s, which I was a part of, and it was reflecting the lifestyles. It was reflecting the fear and paranoia that people had about the Red Scare, about these strange lights being seen in the sky, you know, as a result of the which really kind of kicked off in, I guess, 47 with the Roswell sighting, or crash landing, reputedly. So all of this generation, this decade of the 50s, just happened to be living through it at that time, and I think that probably set the course for a lifelong interest in film and filmmakers.
Tell us a little bit about the role, or perhaps a brief history of music and movies. And
right. Well, you know, it dates back when you look at music associated with movies and, quote, silent films, for that matter, they were never really intended to be silent. You know, even the smallest theaters would have at least a combo in some cases, playing music accompanying the film. Larger cities would have full orchestration. In many cases, actual scores that were written for the film. You know, I mean, recently we had The Phantom of the Opera at the Plaza, which did have an original score written for it, as did many of the major silent films. This was actually very interesting because it wasn't an actual score accompanying the film, but it was an interpretation of music by the Alloy Orchestra. Three very fine musicians and very avid filmmakers in their own right to try to convey a mood based on their own interpretation of scenes. And so it was synchronized to the second, basically. I mean, they were playing live accompanying this silent film. And so I think when you, especially younger people, when they hear the term silent movie, they think, oh, it's going to be boring. It's going to be black and white. It's going to be overly theatrical. It's going to be this, going to be that. But if you give it a chance and see some of the really good films of the silent era, Metropolis, The General with Buster Keaton, I mean, these are some of the best films ever made from any decade, throughout the history of film. So I think music is integral to film. And, of course, you know, it's my understanding, and I could be wrong on this, but certainly not far off from the time frame, that the first original movie soundtrack music score was for Bird of Paradise, Max Steiner, and followed that the following year, 1933, with King Kong. So those are among the very early examples, it's my understanding, just through reading and talking with people that are more knowledgeable than I, that's when it all kind of began as far as writing original music for sound films. And, of course, King Kong still stands up, you know, Max Steiner. And, of course, during the 30s and 40s, Hollywood was attracting the likes of Max Steiner, Frank Skinner, Franz Waxman, Bernard Herrmann, Eric Wolfgang Korngold, and all these wonderful not only conductors but composers too. And a lot of it was European immigrés that were well established in their homeland. They had written concertos. They had written opera. They had written various things, and they were, oh, by the way, we'll go to Hollywood and make a ton of money. You know, I mean, the offers were good, and they were hugely competent. And so I think the golden age of film, which is considered the 30s and 40s, and to me it kind of even spills over into the 50s, you know, you had these great musicians / composer conductors working at the height of their craft, very different from today. You know, there's John Williams. We've lost Elmer Bernstein in recent years, as well as Jerry Goldsmith. But these guys were composers, conductors, and they wrote for 60, 80-piece orchestras. Now, you know, everything has kind of gone the way of electronics, synthesizers, and so forth. And, yeah, it kind of sounds like violins, and, yeah, it kind of sounds like brass. A lot of the sounds are being kind of replicated electronically, so it's not actually 60 or 80 people sitting in seats playing instruments. And I, you know, maybe I'm a little old school, but I just like that. I like the symphonic sound, and I like the hearing great works of art in music being played by individuals that are highly accomplished.
And I guess it was not till the 60s, perhaps Easy Rider, where an actual soundtrack was produced for a film, because, as you mentioned, the scores are the background music setting the tone. But after soundtracks started coming out, people would not necessarily go watch the movie, but they would buy the song from the movie because they liked the soundtrack.
Right. And then it became even more, for lack of a better term, commercial to assign somebody to write a song as a theme or something that's within the body of the film to sell it as a hit single or be part of the soundtrack album. I know that, of course, Easy Rider had a lot of music reflective of that period, and which was a dynamite soundtrack. Breakfast Club kind of did that too. And then George Lucas did it with American Graffiti, with songs from that period, even though the movie was filmed in 73, set in 72, I think, because I remember the catch line on the poster was, "Where were you in 72, I think, or 62, I'm sorry. But a lot of the music was earlier, and it worked because you didn't really think about it, and it was neat hearing the original versions of a lot of these standards on the radio as the kids were tooling around, you know, Mel's Drive-In and so forth in the film. But it's become like everything. I think I can't think of any industry anymore that it's not all about the green first. Some of these old guys, well, they were young at the time, heads of studios, whether it's the Louis B. Mayer or the Harry Cohen or Lasky or Carl Lamelli and so forth. I think they were in many cases could hardly speak English. They came here from Western, Eastern Europe, and so forth. And their main intention was, with this new toy called the motion picture, to entertain. And then it got to be where, let's put relevancy into it, which is fine. But I know, I think it was Samuel Goldwyn that said, if I want messages in my pictures, I'll call Western Union, you know, something like that. So you don't want to hit the audience over the head with it, but if you can slide in either your editorial, you know, thinking on a subject, or in the case of Daryl Zanuck with such films as Pinky and with Gentleman's Agreement, you know, bring to light, you know, the prejudice, bring to light situations that existed in our country during that time, and maybe have it on a more wide scale through film. Because during the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, I mean, people were thronging to the motion picture theaters. And then with television coming in, then they had to think of other ways to get them back in the auditoriums, you know. Like, so we've got stereophonic sound, we have Cinerama, we have 3D. We have CinemaScope, we have color, and so all those kind of were as a result to this new kid called television. You know, people are staying home now. Let's give them something they can't see at home. So let's offer this big sound, big picture, big everything. And now it's kind of gone back to that. You know, we have 3D all over the place now, and even films that weren't shown in 3D originally, they've been converted to 3D in order to get another dime out of that person. So what used to be show business is more, you know, it was show business, and now it's show business, seems like. You know, and it's all about, you know, the opening weekend and how much money the movie makes. And, oh, by the way, they don't mention if the movie's any good. It's just how much money it attracted at the box office. So the industry is just really different now, I think.
Some critics have said, as we talked about music and soundtracks, the fact that Elvis Presley movies really had no plot, and they were just like a giant music video.
Right, right. And pretty much the same story, you know. I mean, okay.
And the Beatles movies, too.
That's true, which I think Hard Day's Night has been kind of credited as being the first music video, really,
right.
You
mm-hmm.
know, in 64. But Elvis, you know, and, you know, Colonel Parker, bless his heart, who's still around, I understand. He's in his 90s and living in Las Vegas, but he didn't want Elvis to veer from that formula. Elvis desperately wanted to do some dramatic work. He really wanted to be in the remake of A Star Is Born opposite Barbara Streisand, which ultimately went to Kris Kristofferson. And Colonel didn't want any part of it. He said, no, 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 no. And did I mention no? But Elvis wanted to do more than just formulaic, I think. You know, he wanted to kind of see if he could, first of all. And there were early examples of it in King Creole and Jailhouse Rock, of a little dramatic.
Charo,
Flaming, absolutely.
Flaming Star
actually wasn't even a musical. I think it had the title song, and that was it. You know, and I think it suffered at the box office, and that's all the Colonel was concerned with. So let's have a lot of songs. We have a soundtrack album now. Elvis, you get at least to be in one fist fight. There's got to be two or more beautiful women in it, and, you know, we'll go with that and variations on it. So as fun as they are, fun in Acapulco, Blue Hawaii, all these wonderful locations, it's pretty much the same movie over and over, you know.
And now we're getting back to, well, let's use another movie as an example, Toy Story 2, which, you know, everyone who has seen it knows it's about toys, but there's that toy collector. And some people are saying, you know, what's happened now is that it's taken the fun out of kids playing with toys, because people will buy toys to keep them in the box, collect them, and not use them. And you being a collector, at what point did you start collecting, and what do you know to save? I mean, if you buy something, do you buy two of them and say this might be worth money someday, or how do you go about doing
that? Well, you know, back, you know, talk about ignorance is bliss. You know, I started collecting because it was movie posters from films I liked. And I had no intention of ever reselling them. I had no intention of putting a cash value on them. And as it turns out, you know, the era that I began collecting, which was in July of 62, so just 50 years ago, a couple of months ago, it was different. And what's considered the baby boomers now, if they didn't obtain, you know, artifacts, lobby cards, posters, whatever, at that time, unless you're a Steven Spielberg or a Lucas or a Joe Dante or somebody that's got the big bucks, trying to replace or trying to acquire films of the 50s even, you know, the classics, The Forbidden Planets, The Day the Earth Stood Still, War of the Worlds, could cost you $12,000, $15,000 upward, you know, for a piece of paper. So it's like I just happened to be around at the time when you could buy things affordably. And it wasn't intended to be an investment or a resale. And, of course, now with eBay and with Craigslist and with all these other opportunities of either buying or selling, it's become like a freight train, you know, going through, you know, just unbridled, open all the valves and go through. But today, I don't really see, you know, an instant collectability in anything that's manufactured because, first of all, in the 30s or even earlier in film, there was paper shortages. They weren't printed to last. They weren't printed for anybody to have other than to be used in a theater exhibition until they wore out, basically, or were thrown away. And now, you know, it's like instant collectability. You know, you can buy reprint posters of Rebel Without a Cause or Giant or you name it. And there's really no value in that. I mean, there's value in the satisfaction of owning a copy of the image that appeared at the time. Same with, you know, like Happy Meal toys or this and that and the other. They make so many millions and millions of these things. There's not going to be any value. You know, okay, you get it for $2 or $3 now, and in 100 years it might be worth $5. You know, I mean, who knows? So it's kind of misleading, I think, to buy anything today that's done as the possibility of hanging on to it and then really making out like a bandit in years to come, unless it's maybe an original one-of-a-kind prop from a film, you know, what they call a hero gun, meaning the one screen used or seen in a film, which you know that there's only one of. But as far as posters or any paper or things like that, of course, you know, the thing, signatures from today's stars, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I mean, they're popular as far as the personalities, Brad Pitt and George Clooney and you name it. You pick them. You pick who you like today. But I don't see the value equated or comparable to like a Carol Lombard or a Clark Gable or a Humphrey Bogart of, you know, days gone by because, you know, I consider many of these older personalities, actors. And I consider most, there are exceptions, but most of the new breed personalities.
Celebrities.
You know, they're playing themselves. And if they have like an interesting characteristic about themselves and the scripts are written for them, you know, and just do this, you know, be you, you know. I can't see a lot of the new people actually assuming the character of a Shakespearean, you know, a Hamlet or a Richard III, with the exception of the British. It seems like even today's crop that's coming out of the UK are so much better at what they do as far as acting, not only for film, but they have the training of stage. They have the background or the training of song and dance if the role requires. And they may or may not be that adept at it, but they have a knowledge of it. Whereas I don't think we teach our people, you know, to be so resourceful and so you can depending on what the role requires. So that's the reason I think that we see most of the current crop, you know, being themselves. And again, kind of being in structurally, it's a different film, but the character's always the same. And I think there's a difference between acting and performing. You know, you have to kind of assume and be the character. I know. It's really a great quote. I think Burt Reynolds, when he was starting out, was following Spencer Tracy around the lot. I think Burt Reynolds was doing Riverboat for TV at the time. Spencer Tracy was doing, I don't know, Judgment at Nuremberg or something on the lot. And he finally had the gumption to get up close enough to him and caught his eye. And Spencer Tracy said, "So, young man, what is it you want to do?" And he said, "I'd like to be an actor." And he says, "Well, good for you. Just don't let them catch you doing it." And I think that says a lot. And I think that stayed with Burt Reynolds. And in effect, what he was saying is, don't act, just be, you know, just react and listen. It's very important to listen to what the other person is saying, because not like wait for the time that you jump in with your dialogue, but actually become that person. And I know Burt Reynolds said that that's lived with him through his career. And, of course, you know, he was no slouch either, especially in the 70s. He was like number one, I think, at the box office. And, then, of course, he did these very – very, very successful smoky pictures and so forth. But he can act. He has acted Deliverance and certain examples. But that was one of the old school guys.
The formula actors.
Yeah.
And that's why some people say that like Daniel Day-Lewis is excellent at Lincoln in this upcoming movie.
You become the character. You don't just spout the lines that somebody wrote. You know, you feel it in your fiber, I think. And I think that's missed on a lot of the young performers. And again, Daniel Day-Lewis is British, right?
Mm-hmm.
So who would have thought, you know, let's get this fine British actor to be this
American president.
Yeah, one of the greatest American presidents, and I'm sure it's going to be wonderful. You know, I mean, I'm there. I'm going to buy it, you know. Anthony Hopkins can do dialects like you wouldn't believe, and you could believe he's from anywhere, you know. So I think it's just a different method of training that goes into this. They take it very seriously. I think it all goes back to whether it's the Vic Theater or whatever, like learn all you can and be versatile enough, you know, for whatever role comes up. And don't turn anything down. If it has a song in it, learn how to sing. You may not be a wonderful singer, but get by. At least do the best you can.
Jay, one of the things that you talked about earlier is the fact that, you know, there are a lot of reproductions being done. And, of course, vinyl is once again popular because it's digitized, and of course it's a lot more expensive than what records used to be. But you told me that one of the hottest selling things as far as like eBay or auctions is Elvis or Beatles stuff, as far mm-hmm. as if they're original
sure.
LPs or unusual.
Yeah, I still have my – I think it's just called Elvis Presley, and it was a pink and blue – lettering of Elvis Presley, a black and white shot of him. I think it was his first album, RCA, and it's been reproduced, of course. You know, I know that version is available on compact disc. But, yeah, you know, I still have my collection of 45s. I still have a huge collection of vinyl, a lot of soundtracks, a lot of classic rock, 50s, 60s. And there's something about vinyl, you know, I mean, obviously if it's scratched and unplayable, you don't want to listen to it. But it probably got that way from listening to it over and over again. But there's something about the ambiance of vinyl, I think, that a lot of the musicians now prefer to go with. You know, in certain cases, they'll do this virgin vinyl thing, and it may be $20 or $30 for a record album, but they want that warmth and that ambiance that vinyl exudes. And I think CDs, as wonderful as they are, as convenient as it is, you can fit more on a shelf and everything, is nearly too antiseptic in some ways. You know, it's yes, all the hisses and pops and everything have been cleaned, but unless you have a Dolby sound system to reproduce that warmth and the bass and that richness of vinyl, it's kind of lacking. It's not quite there. You know, just like digital film projection, you still don't have that black bottom of the well black that you just kind of lose yourself into. It's still a little flat. It's still a little wishy-washy, even though the prints are pristine. You know, whether it be a DVD or a Blu-ray or a projection onto a big screen. There's, you know, people that have seen film, and less of us are around now because you don't see film in theaters anymore. You can tell the difference between that Kodak stock being projected, black and white, or that IB Technicolor 3-strip being projected in 35 millimeter from a CD. It's just different.
As a collector, as you mentioned, so what do you advise as far as telling people what to collect? I mean, because if they're going to be saving everything just in case, they're going to become pack rats, you know, and a lot of people are pack rats anyway. But, you know, you might think like, okay, well, maybe I might save something from the last presidential election because President Barack Obama was the first African-American president elected. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is that going to be worth some money? And, of course, the Antiques Roadshow was here not too long ago, and a lot of people showed up with a lot of stuff. But in some instances, I would imagine it might be more valuable to the person who wants it, and that's what drives the price range when you're on eBay or anything else.
That's true. And I think, too, you know, I always say, first of all, collect what you like, you know. Collect it for you rather than try to anticipate what the masses might be clamoring for, because generally speaking, there's so many wide and diverse tastes out there. You know, you can't be, unless you have more money than good sense to invest in things, you know, like, oh, I think I'll get this because I know there's a market for that. But, yeah, there may be, but how long do you want to sit on that? And do you have the place to store it for this length? I always get a kick, too. I love the Antiques Roadshow, but I always get a kick how they always kind of – it's not really a disclaimer, but they always say, well, a good day at auction, which basically says that it has sold for this much in the past. But that doesn't mean it will again, and it doesn't mean that this quote that I'm – this estimated value I'm giving you is going to be anywhere near, because it's all based on the economy. It's all based on the – you know, who's listening, who's out there. And so I think if you buy for yourself and enjoy your collection, and I think things like you mentioned, you know, like the first African-American presidents, things like that, certainly is historically important. And certainly that would be worth preserving.
Next year would be the 50th anniversary of the President Kennedy's assassination.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there's a lot of things like that. But then again, you know that some enterprising company is going to be releasing these commemorative plaques.
Right.
And don't get it. I mean, obviously, yes, you can get it. But I don't think there's going to be value as far as a collectible, because they're going to be doing so many of these things. And even if they're numbered, everything is kind of numbered. You know, I mean, there's nothing of infinite numbers. But I think if you get what you like, if you enjoy what you have, if it gives you comfort and pleasure of having those items around you, that's the prerequisite. And then if you want to dabble in, you know, other things, you know, that's up to the individual as well.
Well, Jay Duncan, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Jay Duncan, film historian and also collector. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Louis. My pleasure as always.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.